Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Syria has criticized the evacuation from Syria of hundreds of Syrian white helmet rescue workers to Jordan. A Syrian foreign ministry official called the action a criminal process that showed the true nature of the white helmets. The comments were reported by Syria's state-run SANA news service. The official said the evacuation demonstrated the involvement of Israel, the United States, and other Western allies in supporting the white helmets. The group has received support from the U.S. and other Western nations. The volunteer group, officially known as Syria Civil Defense, was formed in 2013. It includes workers who enter attack areas before anyone else to rescue people in rebel-held territory. The group says it is neutral in Syria's civil war. But the Syrian government has accused the White Helmets of working to help rebel fighters. Syrian officials have called the White Helmets a terrorist group. The Jordanian government said in a statement Sunday that 422 White Helmet members were moved from Syria to Jordan. The statement said Jordan agreed to accept the workers after Britain, Germany, and Canada promised to help resettle them in the coming months. The Israeli military cooperated with U.S. and European allies to carry out the evacuation. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke about the action in a video message. He said U.S. President Donald Trump, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and others sought help to move the rescue workers out of Syria. The operation took place near the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. Officials say Syrian troops had surrounded the White Helmets there. Syrian government forces and Russian allies have been fighting an offensive against Syrian rebels in the area. These are people who saved lives and whose lives are now in danger, Netanyahu said. I authorized bringing them through Israel to other countries as an important humanitarian gesture, he added. Britain's Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt praised the evacuation and thanked Israel and Jordan in a tweet. The White Helmets, Hunt said, are the bravest of the brave and in a desperate situation. I'm Brian Lynn.
U.S. President Donald Trump says Iran risks serious consequences if it makes more threats against the United States. Trump's words were written in large letters as part of a Twitter message. It appeared on Twitter Sunday night. It came hours after Iranian President Hassan Rouhani told the American leader that hostile policies toward his country could lead to the mother of all wars. While tensions between the countries have increased, both sides have reasons to want to avoid starting a conflict that could easily intensify. Trump's comments followed a series of speeches and communications meant to incite unrest in Iran. U.S. officials say the Trump administration wants to pressure Iran to end its nuclear program and its support of militant groups. Iran has faced increased U.S. pressure and possible sanctions since May. That is when Trump announced his decision to withdraw the United States from a 2015 international agreement over Iran's nuclear program. In his message directed at Rouhani, Trump wrote, "Never ever threaten the United States again, or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. We are no longer a country that will stand for your demented words of violence and death." Earlier on Sunday, Rouhani had told Iranian diplomats, "Mr. Trump, don't play with the lion's tail. This will only lead to regret." America should know that peace with Iran is the mother of all peace, and war with Iran is the mother of all wars, Rouhani said. The Iranian state news agency, IRNA, reported his comments. Rouhani left open the possibility of peace between the countries. But Iran's most powerful leader, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said on Saturday that negotiations with the United States would be a mistake. Rouhani also made fun of Trump's threat to stop Iranian oil exports. He said Iran has a leading position in the Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz, a major waterway for oil shipping. A commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guards reacted to Trump's threats by saying his country would continue to resist its enemies. Iran's students' news agency, ISNA, reported his comments.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The 19th century American writer and naturalist Henry David Thoreau knew the importance of nature. Thoreau filled his books and notes with observations about human life and its basic need for nature. Those writings have probably never been more important than they are today. On average, Americans spend about 10 hours a day in front of a computer or other electronic device, and less than 30 minutes a day outdoors. That is a claim made by David Strayer, a professor of psychology at the University of Utah. In his 2017 TED Talk, Strayer explained that all this time spent with technology is making our brains tired. Using an electronic device, answering emails, listening to the news, looking at Facebook, puts a lot of pressure on the prefrontal cortex, the front of the brain. This area, Strayer explains, is important for critical thinking, problem solving, and decision making. So it is important to give the brain a rest. And being in nature, Strayer claims, helps refresh a brain that is tired from too much technology. That is when time in the great outdoors and a camping trip can help. Friends and family take time off and escape to nature for several days. They take walks, climb, explore, swim, sleep, eat, and play. Camping may be just what a tech-tired brain needs. Take Carl, for example. He lives in West Virginia and enjoys camping. He says that being outdoors makes him feel at ease. It also prepares him for the work he must do.
So camping gives us a chance to get in touch with nature, and it's a little less busy than our regular day-to-day life. And it's very relaxing. So when you return to work on Monday, generally you're in a better state of mind. And I really like the way I feel on Monday. I'm refreshed for work.
Kate Summers also lives in West Virginia. She says she enjoys camping with her husband and two children. She calls it a regenerative experience, meaning it gives her new life and energy.
I find that it just brings me a measure of peace that comes with the quiet and often the solitude. I find it pretty regenerative and something that I like to do with some regularity so that I keep tapping into that.
Scientists may agree. At the University of Utah, David Strayer has studied both short-term and long-term exposure to nature. He found that spending short amounts of time in nature without technology does calm the brain and helps it to remember better. However, he found it is the long-term contact with nature that does the most good. He and his research team found that spending 3 days in nature without any technology is enough time for the brain to fully relax and reset itself. He calls this the three-day syndrome. He claims that spending long amounts of time in nature will help rest and recharge the brain, improve our productivity, lower our stress levels, and make us feel better. Kate Summers agrees. She says that while long walks are great, camping for several days is a better, more complete experience.
I feel like gives us all the ability to kind of immerse ourselves more in the outdoors rather than just going on a day hike. Here you get to spend more time out of doors and just kind of be in the space rather than necessarily always moving through it.
Camping, Carl adds, teaches you to know your surroundings and to think about one thing at a time. This is similar to Strayer's claim that being in nature calms the brain and helps it to focus. It can show you how to take care of yourself in difficult situations, and this can help to increase your confidence in your abilities.
Well, I think being more aware in general is something that transfers well to day-to-day life. I think being able to focus on one task, I think the self-confidence of knowing you can take care of yourself in an adverse environment carries over well to day-to-day life.
Giving your brain a rest so that it can work better is a great reason to go camping. But it is not the only reason. Nature is a great teacher.
And learning about animals and the natural environment and how that sort of thing works is different when it's hands-on than when it's in school. Learning to deal with the weather and learning to stay dry in the rain or warm in the snow. Learning how to keep your feet in good condition when you're hiking and walking. Learning how to dress for the elements.
Kate Summers adds that her camping experiences have given her confidence to deal with problems.
It is definitely more challenging at the beginning, just to sort of be able to anticipate what you'll need and to know how to deal with certain situations.
So taking a long walk in the woods or by the ocean or in a city park is, of course, wonderful. But camping requires that you spend more time in nature, and it can test you in different ways. You must immerse yourself more deeply in nature, and the health benefits can be deeper as well. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Britain was once the most powerful nation in the world. It ruled a far-reaching empire. We look at how British power gave way to American influence after World War II. One can almost name the day when this happened. It was February 21st, 1947. British diplomats in Washington called the State Department. They had two messages from their government. The first was about Greece. The situation there was critical. Greece had been occupied by Germany during the war. Now it was split by a bitter civil war. On one side of the fighting was the Greek royal family, supported by Britain. On the other side were communist-led rebels, supported by Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union. British forces had helped keep Greece from becoming communist at the end of World War II. A few years later, Britain could no longer help. It needed all its strength to rebuild after the war. So on that February day in 1947, Britain told the United States it would soon end all support for Greece. Britain's second message that day was about Turkey. Turkey was stronger than Greece, but the concern was that it too could become communist unless it received outside help. Britain warned the United States that the Soviet Union would soon extend its control all the way across Eastern Europe to the Eastern Mediterranean. It called on President Harry Truman to provide strong American support to help Greece and Turkey resist the communist threat. Britain, in effect, was asking the United States to take over leadership of the Western world. The United States was ready to accept this new responsibility. For months, relations between the United States and the Soviet Union had been growing worse and worse. The two countries had fought together as allies in the Second World War. But Soviet actions after the war shocked the American people. The Soviet Union wanted to block Western political and economic influence in Central and Eastern Europe. It wanted to extend its own influence instead. So after the war, it forced a number of countries to establish communist governments.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
Britain's Prime Minister Winston Churchill described the situation in a speech in March of 1946 at Westminster College in the American state of Missouri.
Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow.
Churchill warned that the Soviet Union was trying to expand its power. He described it as an iron curtain falling across the middle of Europe. This iron curtain divided Europe into a communist East and a democratic West. The situation was made even more tense by news coming from China. China was a divided nation at the end of World War II. The forces of nationalist leader Chiang Kai-shek controlled the southwestern part of the country. Communist forces under Mao Zedong controlled the north. Both the United States and the Soviet Union expected that Chiang Kai-shek would be able to unite China. Chiang and the Nationalists won several early victories over the Communists, but Mao and his forces used a growing hatred of the Nationalist government to win support. Slowly, they began to win battles and capture arms. Early in 1949, Communist forces took control of Peking, now Beijing, and Tianjin. They captured Shanghai and Canton. By the end of the year, Chiang and his nationalist forces had to flee to the island of Taiwan. The fall of the nationalist government on the mainland caused a bitter political debate in America. Some critics of the Truman administration thought the United States had not done enough to help the Nationalists. The Truman administration rejected the charges. It said Chiang caused his own defeat by failing to reform and win the support of the Chinese people. Secretary of State Dean Acheson described the defeat this way. The unfortunate but inescapable fact is that the ominous result of the civil war in China was beyond the control of the government of the United States. Nothing that this country did or could have done within the reasonable limits of its capabilities could have changed that result. Nothing that was left undone by this country has contributed to it. It was the product of internal Chinese forces, forces which this country tried to influence but could not. A decision was arrived at within China, if only a decision by default. The United States was more successful in its policies toward Europe. The British warnings about the communist threat in Greece and Turkey led President Truman to speak to Congress. He said, "I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures." Truman called on Congress to give him $400 million in aid for Greece and Turkey. After a brief but intense national debate, Congress agreed. Truman then launched an effort to save the Greek economy and reorganize the Greek army. Soon after that, Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union ended their aid to Greek rebels. The civil war in Greece ended. American help for Greece and Turkey was the first step in what became known as the Truman Doctrine. The goal of this policy was to stop Soviet aggression anywhere in the world. Truman was willing to use military force to stop the spread of communism, but he also believed it was equally important to build up Western European nations so they would be strong enough to defend themselves. Europe was suffering terribly after World War II. There were severe shortages of food and fuel. Crops were destroyed. Many Europeans were beginning to look to the communists, to anybody, to save them. This is one reason why Truman and his advisors developed a plan to rebuild the economies of Europe. After the war, President Truman made George Marshall his Secretary of State. Marshall had led American troops as a general in World War II. Now, as the nation's top diplomat, he proposed the idea for rebuilding Europe. This idea became known as the Marshall Plan. President Truman explained why there had to be a Marshall Plan. People were starving, he said. There had been food riots in France and Italy. There was not enough fuel. People were cold and sick. Tuberculosis was breaking out. As Truman said later, something had to be done. Secretary of State Marshall described the plan during a congressional hearing in Washington.
Why must the United States carry so great a load in helping Europe? The answer is simple. The United States is the only country in the world today which has the economic power and productivity to furnish the needed assistance. The 6 8/10 billion proposed for the first 15 months is less than a single month's charge of the war. To be quite clear, this unprecedented endeavor of the new world to help the old is neither sure nor easy. It is a calculated risk. It is a difficult program. And you know far better than I do the political difficulties involved in this program. But there's no doubt whatever in my mind that if we decide to do this thing, we can do it successfully. And there's also no doubt in my mind that the whole world hangs in the balance as to what it is to be.
The United States offered aid through the Marshall Plan to all countries in Europe. The Soviet Union and its allies refused help. 16 other countries, however, welcomed the aid. From 1948 to 1952, administrators of the Marshall Plan worked with these countries. The United States spent $13 billion. The plan worked. Agricultural production in Marshall Plan countries increased by 10%. Industrial production increased by 35%. Production in some industries, such as steel, increased by much more. There were political results as well. Stronger economies helped prevent communists from gaining control of the governments in France and Italy. Some Europeans criticized the Marshall Plan. They said it increased tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union in the years after the war. Yet few could deny that the plan was one of the most successful international economic programs in history.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.